Brand new unit. This one will be three chapters. Actually, all the rest of the units are three chapters each. The first unit of chapter, the first chapter of unit two is about the macromolecules that organisms are made out of. Now, we talked in a previous chapter about the atoms that organisms are made out of. I gave you a table of elements, meaning the kinds of atoms that organisms are made out of and their relative abundances. Now we'll talk about molecules that make up organisms. And there's all kinds of small molecules like water and oxygen and so on. But there, in any given organism, are four categories of biological macromolecules. Macro simply means big. So compared to run-of-the-mill molecules like water, macromolecules are very large. They're made of a lot of atoms. And doesn't matter what organism you're talking about, there are four major categories, as I said, of these biological macromolecules. They're organic macromolecules. All of them are carbon-containing. And let me just list them for you, because you might have actually learned a different list. The four biological macromolecule categories are proteins, or you might list them as polypeptides. I'll explain how those two words differ later. So that's one. Lipids is another. A third is polynucleotides. Which could also be called nucleic acids. And the fourth is polysaccharides. So typically when I ask people what the four are, they will say proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, and carbohydrates. And you might even read that in books, but that's, strictly speaking, not true. Carbohydrates aren't necessarily big molecules. For instance, the glucose that you built, that's a carbohydrate. All right, so carbohydrates is a huge category of molecules, only some of which are big. Monosaccharides are small carbohydrates. But when you hook a bunch of monosaccharides together, you make macromolecules, big carbohydrates that are called polysaccharides. So this is the correct word for the macromolecular class. Okay, those are the four. And we're going to look at all of these individually, but let me tell you something else about them before we actually get to slide one. Three of these four categories officially qualify as polymers. Polymer is a word that literally means many part. Mer means part. Poly means many. So polymers are not only big molecules. They're big molecules that are made by hooking together a bunch of small subunits called monomers. And three of these four categories of biological macromolecules that I just gave you are polymers. Do you know which one is not? Lipids. Lipids are large molecules. I include them in the four categories, but they're built differently. They're not as big, for one thing, but they're also not built by hooking together a bunch of subunits. So they are not polymers. The other three are. Well, the word polypeptide, if you use that instead of protein, kind of tells you that it's a polymer. And similarly, instead of calling a nucleic acid, you call it a polynucleotide. The word tells you it's a polymer. And polysaccharides, of course, does as well. Now we can go to slide one, and notice it uses the words polymer and monomer here, But actually, the important information here applies not only to the polymers, the three that are I said are polymers, but it also applies to lipids. So the important thing about this slide is true for all four categories, even lipids, even though they're not polymers. The point here is that if you have a large molecule, a biological macromolecule, if you want to build one, I should say, if you want to build a big molecule out of smaller pieces, then the process is the same for all four categories. You start with two pieces that need to be put together. That's what the top represents here, the top row. And notice that one of the chunks has a hydrogen hanging off of it somewhere, and the other piece has a hydroxyl or an OH hanging off of it somewhere. And that allows for hooking these two things together to make a bigger thing. You remove the hydrogen from one part and the OH from the other part. Those three atoms come together as water, H2O. They're no longer part of the molecule you're building. Water comes out, in other words. But that leaves, if you think of this in terms of ball and stick models, removing the H and the OH from the other one leaves some sticks that still need some bonds that could still be formed, right? So that allows you to hook the two pieces together. And that's what has happened here. One, two, and three from one chunk, and this one from the other become this four-part chunk. That is a specific kind of reaction called a dehydration reaction. That's one name for it, as you see here. That's the word that makes more sense. It can also be called a condensation reaction by some books. But dehydration really makes sense because dehydration means remove water. And you remove water from the situation because one of the pieces loses an H and the other piece loses an OH. Together they make water. That reaction, a dehydration reaction, can be reversed. The exact reverse of this is called a hydrolysis reaction, shown below A in B. Lysis is a general word that means splitting. So you see that in several words in biology. But hydrolysis means water splitting, using water to split something big into smaller chunks. It's the exact reverse of dehydration. So instead of water coming out, you have to put water in order to split this big thing into smaller things. But it's exactly the reverse. So the water that you put into it gets split into an H and an OH, so that when you break the bond somewhere in the big molecule, one of the pieces will get the H and the other piece will get the OH. All right. So both of these happen all the time in cells. We're always building bigger things with dehydration reactions. We're always breaking big things down into smaller chunks with hydrolysis reaction for various reasons. And so that applies to all four macromolecular classes. That's really the only general slide. Now we'll go on one by one to a survey of the four categories. Starting with polysaccharides, even though in slide two what you're looking at are not polysaccharides. These are all carbohydrates, which polysaccharides are, but these are different kinds of polysaccharides. These are monosaccharides. These are small sugars, simple sugars. The reason they're important for a discussion, though, of polysaccharides is that you build polysaccharides by hooking together monosaccharides. These are monosaccharides, monomers in general, that can be used to make a polymer. And if you look at this is by no means even close to all of the monosaccharides. There are really an unlimited number of monosaccharides that could be built in the lab. These are just a little sample. But what you notice that all of these share is what's highlighted in salmon color here. What is that?
Carbonyl.
It's a carbonyl group. These are monosaccharides, as I just said, but as we'll see in a minute, any given monosaccharide can exist in this form, which is called the linear form, or a ringed form. These are called linear because the carbon skeleton does not loop back around and connect onto itself. It doesn't form a ring. All right, these are the linear forms. And for any given monosaccharide in the linear form, which these are all, you have a carbonyl somewhere. So a carbon and an oxygen. And this table is arranged to show you that there are two fundamentally different ways to categorize monosaccharides as a group. And the two different, what I mean by fundamentally different ways is that neither way of categorization has anything to do with the other way of categorizing. So if we look at the columns first, glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone both are in this column together because they qualify as trioses. Well, that word ends in O-S-E. And an O-S-E ending is often used for sugars in general. Sugars meaning carbohydrates. So when you see O-S-E ending, you're talking about some sort of carbohydrate. It doesn't mean that every carbohydrate has a name that ends in O-S-E. There are some exceptions, but that's what O-S-E should tell you. And what the columns are indicating is that you can categorize monosaccharides based on the number of carbons in the skeleton. What glyceraldehyde and dihydroxyacetone have in common is that they have three carbons in the skeleton. And so they are called trioses, literally meaning three sugars, three carbon sugars. The pentoses, pent meaning five, have five carbons. Now notice that all pentoses have the same chemical formula, just like all trioses have the same chemical formula. And all hexoses do. Hex just means six. Let's look at that formula, though. For trioses, it's C3H6O3, pentoses C5H10O5, and so on. The general formula for a monosaccharide, where you don't really know how many carbons there are for it to be a general formula, we just call it N, right? CN. And then there's twice as many hydrogens, so it would be 2N. And then there's the same number of oxygens as there are carbons. So CNH2NON would be the general formula for a monosaccharide. You see how that obeys it for all these? Okay, well, kind of by analogy with the distributive property in math, you can simplify this general formula by calling it CN, and then in parentheses, H2O with N outside of the parentheses. This becomes 2N, this becomes N. You see that? The reason this is useful to write it this way is to explain why these things were called carbohydrates. They have this general formula which makes them look like they are carbon and water, carbohydrate. All right? But that general formula is for monosaccharides only. When you start hooking them together, that no longer applies. So one way of categorizing these is by number of carbons in the skeleton, trioses and so on. But the rows pays attention to something entirely different. Notice that all the ones in this top row have the carbonyl at a tip of the skeleton. And so what does that qualify these as chemically? What do we call substances whose carbonyl group is at a tip of the skeleton?
Carbonyl
not allowed to forget this test one information, even though you've been tested on it already. They are aldehydes, right? Just like A is at a tip of the alphabet. So these are aldehyde sugars, which in one word is called an aldose. Aldehyde sugar, aldoses. Okay? Whereas these carbonyls for the second row are not. They're ketones, right? Because if the carbonyl is anywhere except at a tip, then instead of being an aldehyde, it's a ketone. These are ketone sugar or ketoses. Okay, let's go to three. I just told you a little bit ago that a linear monosaccharide can be transformed into a ringed version. So for any given monosaccharide, there's multiple versions. There's a linear version and a ring version. They have the same name as a substance, like glucose, for instance, but there's two different versions as far as the molecular structure is concerned. Here we have glucose, but the same would be true of any hexose. This is a 6-carbon sugar in linear form, and you can wrap this carbon skeleton around so that carbon 6 bonds with carbon 2 to form a ring. That's what you have on the right side. All right. Notice, by the way, that doing that, and if you imagine doing this with your ball and stick models, there's no way you could make that ring unless you open up some bonds so that you can make that complete the ring. You see what I'm saying? So you need to get rid of this double bond in the carbon that's involved in the carbonyl in order to complete the ring, to hook it together with this O. Right here, this bond right here. And what that means is that in the ringed form, a monosaccharide no longer has a carbonyl group. Only the linear version has a carbonyl group. Right. This, by the way, is why Benedict's solution, remember doing the Benedict's test? It's why Benedict's solution will not be positive if you give it starch, which is nothing but glucose is hooked together. But the reason that it is negative is because in order to hook two monosaccharides together to form a bigger sugar, they have to be in the ringed form. And when they're in the ring form, they no longer have the double bond of the carbonyl, which is the source of the electron that reduces carbon 2 into carbon 1. So there's no available electrons to turn the blue carbon 2s into brick red carbon 1s. It has to be monosaccharides by themselves. And notice this is a reversible reaction. So monosaccharides on their own, that aren't hooked to anything else, are very quickly going back and forth between linear and ring form many times a second. But when they're in that linear form, then they're available to reduce copper. That's why they're called reducing sugars. Okay, in four, we can see some bonds being made between two monosaccharides. Notice these are already in the ring form, which is what I just said is a requirement for being able to hook them together. And notice that this is following the pattern that was on that first slide. One of the pieces has an H, one of the pieces has an OH somewhere. Those three atoms come out as water in the dehydration reaction, and that allows you to make a bond between the two monosaccharides to form a two sugar compound, a two subunit sugar called a disaccharide. Monosaccharides are one subunit, disaccharides are two subunits big. In this case, the two specific monosaccharides are glucoses. And two glucoses hooked together to form a disaccharide form the specific disaccharide called maltose, malt sugar. That bond that's formed, now the process is dehydration to do that. Dehydration always refers to making bonds to build bigger pieces out of smaller. But, and so that's going to be true of all four categories is what I'm saying, dehydration. But if you're specifically talking about linking two monosaccharides together as opposed to what gets linked together in the other categories, then the specific kind of bond that forms from that dehydration reaction between the two constituent monosaccharides is called a glycosidic linkage. Glyco means sugar. Well, on the bottom, we have the same exact reaction type occurring, but now we're hooking glucose and fructose together to form sucrose, also a disaccharide, but it's a different disaccharide compared to maltose. This sucrose is table sugar. Since there are many, many monosaccharides, that means there are even more disaccharides because you can match any one with any one of the others. All right, we still haven't gotten up to through slide four to anything big enough to qualify as a macromolecule yet. Those were all carbohydrates, but they were small. When you keep adding subunits, though, using additional dehydration reactions to keep adding subunits, making the sugar bigger and bigger, then you get to officially a big molecule called a polysaccharide. And now we're finally looking at two examples in slide five. On the left, we have starch, which is made by plants. On the right, we have glycogen, which is made by animals, including, of course, us. Now, they have a lot in common, these two examples. One is that in both cases, even though they're different molecules, they're both made out of nothing but glucose. Now, you could make a polysaccharide out of other monosaccharides as well, but these two examples are made out of just nothing but glucose, a lot of them, though, hooked together. And how they're hooked together is different between the two. That's one of the differences. But it's pure glucose when you really get down to it. Another thing they have in common, though, is what they are used for. So when it comes to polysaccharides, functionally speaking, there are two major categories. One of which is storage polysaccharides. And these are examples of storage polysaccharides. They get that name because the reason they are built by the organism out of glucose to begin with is for the purpose of storing energy in the form of glucose. Glucose, as we'll talk much more about in Unit 3, is the master fuel for all cells. Not just cells of your body, all cells. So it's the most important source of energy for organisms, glucose. But to use it for energy, it has to be in the form of glucose on its own, as a monosaccharide. All right? Well, when more glucose is taken in than is needed at the moment, like after a meal, you know, first of all, we don't put food into our bodies. We say we do, but we really don't. We put food into the alimentary canal, which is a continuous tube from mouth to anus, but that is outside of the body, right? If I stick my finger in my mouth, it's not in my body. It's in the airspace in that alimentary canal. So the food is outside of the body. The body's wrapped around the food. We secrete enzymes out of the body into that space, the alimentary canal, to digest the big molecules into the ones that are small enough to get into the cells. That happens at the small intestine, finally, is when we finally put that stuff into our body, absorb it. Anyway, it gets delivered to the blood. So after digestion, after a meal, the glucose level in the blood starts to rise. You have way more than you need to supply your body with energy at the moment. But we've evolved to not waste that extra energy. So we store it. Organisms in general, not just us. And we, when we're storing it for the purpose of later using it as an energy source, what we're really doing is just storing it in a more compact form. It's a lot more efficient to store the extra glucoses if you hook them together into a big molecule than it is to save them as individual glucoses. This is a major job of the liver, by the way. It will take up that extra glucose when the blood spikes in glucose level after a meal, and it'll make glycogen molecules, because we're animals. But then later, when it's hours since you've eaten, and your brain needs a continuous supply of glucose, or you'll die, when it dips too low, then the liver breaks the glycogen it made earlier back down into glucose and puts it out into the blood, keeping you alive. So anyway, that's what a storage polysaccharide is. It's a polysaccharide built for the purpose of later dismantling it so that you can use the individual glucoses as fuel. Plants do the same thing, but notice when they connect their glucoses, there's not as much branching as there is in us. The reason that's important, by the way, for an animal is because animals are active, much more active than plants. So they need to quickly dismantle their storage polysaccharides to get access to those glucoses. And the more branches you have, the more you can pick away at individual glucoses from the ends because it has a lot more tips. But that's a storage polysaccharide. The other category, I told you there were two categories of polysaccharides. The other category is structural polysaccharides, which we'll get an example of in a minute. Slide 6 actually shows you one of each. This is starch on the left. We just looked at that in the previous example. Cellulose on the right. Plants make both of these. Told you that plants make starch. That's the plant version of storage polysaccharides. Plants also make cellulose, which is the most abundant polysaccharide in nature. You're writing on cellulose right now on paper. That's a structural polysaccharide because it's not made for the purpose of storing energy. It's made for the purpose of building something, to use it as a structural element. Notice, though, that both starch and cellulose are nothing but glucoses hooked together. They are hooked together different ways, though. So look at the top here. Not only does glucose have two different versions in that it can be linear or ringed, but you can actually form two different kinds of ring structures that are both considered to be glucose. Here you have alpha glucose on the left, beta glucose on the right, and they are almost identical if you look at these structural formulae. The chemical formula is identical, of course. They're isomers of each other. But the structural formula is slightly different. Notice that on carbon 1 here, which is why this has a 1, this is carbon number 1, the hydroxyl is above the plane here, and on alpha it's below this plane. That's the only difference. But that makes a difference when it gets to hooking together multiple versions of these. Starch, notice, uses alpha glucoses hooked together for their glycosidic linkages. Cellulose uses beta glucose. And when you make cellulose, you're really forming a long, thin strand that is strong, but will be much stronger if you make a bunch of other similar strands and then put them in parallel like strands of a rope. That's exactly what happens in cellulose. It's a structural element, and we see that in slide 7. Each of these individual cellulose polymers is bundled together with a bunch of others to form a rope-like strand that is very strong. That's why the plant's doing it. Not to use the glucose that's it contains as fuel later, these are more or less permanent structures that are going to be serving as structures. Okay, now to eight. Well, we have a cow here with a picture of what's going on in one of its stomachs. The reason this applies to this chapter is that, speaking of cellulose, which is a structural polysaccharide I just told you, it still is made out of glucose, right, as I told you. And so even though the plant made it originally for the purpose of being a structure, another organism could still dismantle it and use those individual glucoses for fuel. In other words, it has just as much energy in the form of fuel as starch would have, or glycogen. But if we eat paper, or eat cellulose, which paper is made of, it's not going to give you any nutritive value. It's going to pass through you as roughage, even though it's nothing but energy in the form of glucose. We can't get any nutrition out of, we animals can't get any nutrition out of cellulose, because we don't have the correct enzymes that can break those specific glycosidic linkages holding the glucoses together. So it stays outside of our body in the digestive tract as cellulose. It can't be broken down. And therefore, we can't get any energy benefit from those glucoses. Well, that's also true for a cow. Animals in general don't have these enzymes, which are proteins, by the way. Enzymes are proteins. And the reason we don't have them is because we don't have the gene that tells the cell how to build that particular protein. And therefore, no cell can build any protein unless it's told how to do it, which is what a gene does. Well, cows don't have that gene either, but they get nutrition value from the cellulose in the grass that they eat. Not because they have the gene, but because bacteria have the gene for it. Bacteria are able to do it, and cows house bacteria in one of their stomachs that have just the right enzyme to do this. This, by the way, is an example. This living arrangement between these two species, the cow and the bacterium, is an example of symbiosis. This literally means situation of living together. Osis means condition. Bi, as in bio, means living. And sim means together. So a symbiosis is a close living relationship between two organisms, two species, really. Even more specifically, this is an example of endosymbiosis. Endo meaning within, because one of the two involved species lives inside the other species. Now, not all symbioses are beneficial to both. Like a parasite, for instance, is a symbiosis, but it's not good for both involved, right? It's only good for one. This is a mutualistic symbiosis, though, meaning both of the species involved benefit. The cow benefits, of course, because it gets energy from the cellulose that would otherwise just pass right through it. And, of course, the bacteria benefit because they are given a nice, safe, moist, temperature-controlled environment to live, and they're given free food continuously as long as the cow eats. Slide 9 shows you that it's not only plants that produce structural polysaccharides. Other groups of organisms do as well, including animals shown here. Chitin is a structural polysaccharide that animals produce, specifically insects, which have exoskeletons. We have an endoskeleton, our hard parts are deep inside us. insects are soft interior, and they wear plate armor, more or less, an exoskeleton. And that hard exterior is made out of tough structural polysaccharide called chitin that we take advantage of its strength by making surgical thread out of it, as you see. Okay, that is one of the categories. That's polysaccharides. So now it's on to the next major category, which is lipids. And we are looking here on the bottom, in part B, at a fat molecule. But I want to say right away that the word lipid and the word fat are not interchangeable terms. Sometimes people use them this way. If you think about it in Venn diagram terms or sets, lipids is a big set. Fats is a subset within lipids. To put that another way, all fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. There are other kinds of lipids besides fats. So don't use the words interchangeably. Another thing is that a fat molecule, which we're looking at on the bottom here, can go by any of three names that are actually interchangeable. Fat is by far the easiest to say and spell, but fats can also be called triglycerides and they can also be called triacyl glycerols. What you call them actually depends mostly on what kind of person you are. A non-scientist would call them fats. Most biologists would call them triglycerides. Most biochemists would call them triacyl glycerols. But those three words mean exactly the same thing, and you can use any of the three. The reason that triacyl glycerol is kind of a good word, though, even though it's harder to write out and say than fat, is because it tells you how a fat is built, which is what's shown on this slide. So on the top, ignore the orangish shading. Just look at the gray shading here. If this gray thing were by itself, it would be a molecule in its own right, called glycerol. And what kind of thing is glycerol, based on its name? No, glycerol is not a fat. Based on its name. It ends in O-L. And therefore it is an alcohol. Alcohol names end in OL, like propanol, ethanol, and so on. Cholesterol. If you didn't see a picture of it, but just had the name glycerol, it should tell you that it's an alcohol from that name only. And therefore, without looking at the structural formula, you should know that it has what in order to be an alcohol? It has a hydroxyl group, at least one. Well, this one has three. So it's actually triply an alcohol. Okay? Glycerol is an alcohol. That would be a molecule in its own right if there's nothing attached to it. But think about that opening slide today where you have OHs. That's a potential connection point for a dehydration reaction to build a bigger piece. So the H's of these OHs are what are used in dehydration reactions. And since there are three of those, that means there are three connection points on glycerol to connect three things to. And if you're building a fat, then all three of the things that you're going to attach to the glycerol are the same kind of thing, even though they might not be identical to each other. They're the same kind of thing called a fatty acid. The fatty acid is just the orange part, not the whole thing. Now, a fatty acid, there's different kinds of fatty acids, but any given fatty acid has this at the end. What is the functional group that's at the left end of this fatty acid?
Carboxyl?
Yes, it's a carboxyl. Looks like it's a hydroxyl, right? But the whole thing is a carboxyl, remember. That's not a carbonyl and a hydroxyl. It's one carboxyl. So a fatty acid is a carboxyl group with a hydrocarbon chain. The fatty acid is not truly a hydrocarbon because it has that oxygen in it of the carboxyl. But if you look at just the rest of the fatty acid other than the carboxyl group, it's nothing but carbons and hydrogens. So it's a fatty, it's a hydrocarbon tail with a carboxyl group at one end. That's a fatty acid. And I think I already told you that carbon-hydrogen bonds, which are what you find in hydrocarbons, are sources of energy, which is why hydrocarbons in general form excellent fuels, like in gasoline, for instance, a mixture of hydrocarbons. Well, fatty acids are almost hydrocarbons, and therefore they store a lot of energy as well. Well, if you take three fatty acids and individually connect them to one of the connection points of the glycerol, you have what's on the bottom here, which is now a complete fat. But the word triacylglycerol, which is just another name for fat, tells you that it's a glycerol with three acyls. The acyls are the fatty acids. All right? And just like we had a special name for the bond that was formed in a dehydration reaction between two monosaccharides, which was glycosidic linkage, as we talked about, we have a new name if the thing you're building is a fat. It's still the same process, a dehydration reaction to hook the two things together. But when you hook a fatty acid to a glycerol, what's formed is an ester linkage. And one fat, or one triglyceride, or one triacyl glycerol, has three ester linkages, one for each of the three fatty acids that are connected to that glycerol. This is why fats are such excellent storage molecules for energy purposes. Because all of these CH bonds are tappable sources of energy. You know, when some candies are really nothing but sugar, like Jolly Rancher, for instance. And a lot of candy labels will have, as a selling point, no fat on the label, which is true. It's just pure sugar. But it has a lot of calories in it, and if you eat a lot of it, you're going to have much more calories, much more energy taken in as food than you need, and the body will store it in efficient form, which is as fat. So no, the candy doesn't have any fat, but your body will produce fat to store that energy that was in the candy. And that's because fats have a much higher energy density than proteins or polysaccharides do. The energy density of a nutrient is how much energy is contained per gram. And a gram of fat contains more than twice as much energy as a gram of polysaccharide or a gram of protein. That's why we don't store our extra energy as proteins or carbohydrates, polysaccharides. If we did do that, we would have to weigh more to store that same amount of energy, because we'd be using something with less energy density. Okay, now let's go to... Well, before I leave this, let me tell you that there are... Any fat is produced this way, but there are many kinds of fats. All fats have this basic structure, but not all fats are the same chemical. Now, glycerol is always the same, so that doesn't vary from fat to fat. Therefore, the reason there are different kinds of fats has something to do with fatty acids. There are different kinds of fatty acids, in other words. These fatty acids in this particular fat shown here happen to be the same as each other. Some fats feature three of the same fatty acids. It doesn't have to be the case, though. But just by looking at these pictures, can you think of a way that fatty acids can be different from each other? How could this one be different from these two if you changed it? What change could you make?
More or less carbon?
Exactly. There's nothing saying you have to end here, right? If instead of just having a hydrogen at this end, you add another carbon with hydrogens, then it's an even longer chain length. So that's one fundamental way in which fatty acids can be different from each other in the number of carbons. Okay, and therefore, fats can be different if they're made of fatty acids that differ in their lengths. That's one way. Now on slide 11, we see a different way, unrelated to chain length, how fatty acids can differ. And this has to do with what's called saturation. There are two categories of fatty acids with respect to saturation. They are called saturated fatty acids and unsaturated fatty acids. All right. Now notice on the top, this is the same fat that we saw in the previous slide. All three of these fatty acids are nice and straight. On the bottom, this one fatty acid that's in the fat is not straight, it's bent. And the reason that it's bent is because of this double bond that's here. These other fatty acids, the ones that are straight, have no double bonds between carbons. Okay, it's just only single bonds. Well, think about the word saturation. What does it actually mean in everyday language? What does it mean for something to be saturated? It's full of something, right? Like a saturated towel is soaked with water. It can't hold anymore. In the case of a fatty acid, we say it is saturated when it's holding the maximum number of hydrogens that it can hold. Now, a saturated fatty acid doesn't have any double bonds. It's only single bonds between the carbons. And it'll make it more clear if I temporarily go back to slide 10 to show you this. So these are all single bonds, right? But think about carbon. Has a valence of 4. So any of these carbons in the middle of the chain is already making 2 bonds with the 2 carbons on either side. That leaves 2 empty holes it has to fill, right? So you have to put in 2 hydrogens to fill those holes. And if all you have are single bonds for all the carbon-carbons, then you're holding the maximum number of hydrogens possible. It's, in other words, saturated with hydrogens. That's why we call it a saturated fatty acid. But when you make a double bond on any of these, or between any of these 2 carbons, then that takes up a hole, right? You have to get rid of a hydrogen to do that. From each of the carbons involved, if you form a double bond, you have to get rid of 2 hydrogens in order to make that double bond. So it's no longer holding the maximum number of hydrogens. It's no longer saturated with hydrogens. And we called it an unsaturated fatty acid. But the effect of that double bond is that it puts a kink into the structure. So they're not straight, they're bent. And this has biological implications. If you, by analogy, think of wires to represent fatty acids, Fatty acids can differ in their length. So you can have wires of different lengths. But let's say you have a bunch of wires, all the same kind of wire, and all of it straight, even though it could be different lengths. If you kind of haphazardly throw those wires into a box, stiff wire I'm talking about, like coat hanger, if they're all straight, then they're going to pack nicely close together, even if they are different lengths, right? But now imagine bending them. Bend each one, and it doesn't matter where in the, along the length you bend it. If you have a bunch of bent wires and you throw them into a box, they're not going to stack together nicely. There's going to be more space between them. And similarly, if you make a what's called a saturated fat, which is any fat that has only saturated fatty acids, so three straight ones, saturated fats don't have as much space in them. And they therefore are more like solids at room temperature because of that closer spacing. Butter is saturated fat. Animals in general tend to make more saturated fats than unsaturated. And butter is an animal-sourced fat. Plants, on the other hand, make more unsaturated fats. An unsaturated fat doesn't have to have all three fatty acids unsaturated. It has to have at least one. But it could be all three. This one is unsaturated because this fatty acid is unsaturated. And therefore, they don't pack together. They're more loose and therefore more liquid at room temperature. They're oils instead of butter. By the way, there are degrees of saturation as well. There's only one way to be unsaturated as a fatty acid, and that's to have no double bonds. But a fatty acid can be either monounsaturated, meaning there's only one double bond in it, or polyunsaturated, because there's nothing saying you can't form a double bond somewhere else as well. And that's why on food labels you might see the words monounsaturated fats and polyunsaturated fats, depending on how many double bonds are there. Okay, that is just one category of lipids. Now on to 12. 12 is another lipid, but this one is not a fat, even though it kind of looks like it. Notice in part of this gray, you have a glycerol. That's exactly the same glycerol that's in a fat. And it has the same three connection points where you can hook things to it. Now, if you were building a fat, all three of those things you hook to it would be fatty acids. But this is not the case. Only two fatty acids are hooked here. Right? That leaves one more connection point on the glycerol. Instead of hooking a third fatty acid, this molecule hooks a phosphate group to it. So this is not a fat. This is a lipid called a phospholipid, obviously named for the fact that it has that phosphate group connected to the glycerol. And I briefly mentioned phospholipids when I was telling you about the importance of phosphate groups, the many reasons why we can't live without phosphate. Well, this might be the biggest reason why no organisms can exist without phosphate, because all cells are made up chiefly, not entirely, but mostly of phospholipid molecules. I shouldn't say cells. All cell membranes, all plasma membranes, are mostly phospholipid molecules. And therefore, the first cells, our ancestors, couldn't have come into existence without these phospholipid molecules accumulating in the environment. All cells that have ever existed are made out of phospholipids. All plasma membranes are. The reason for that has to do with a special property of phospholipids. They are examples of molecules that are called amphipathic. Now, the pathic part of the and has to do with feeling, like sympathy and empathy. Pathos. Of course, the molecule doesn't have any feeling. We're giving it human qualities, but that's what that means. And what about amphi? What does that mean? You know some words with amphi, I'm sure. What are some other words?
Amphibian.
Yeah, amphibian is a great example because it's a biological term. The bi, just like in the other word I was using earlier, symbiosis, biology, means life. Amphi means dual or both. And so an amphibian, an amphibian, is named for the fact that it has a dual lifestyle. Part of its life is lived in water, the other part on land. And similarly, an amphitheater is partly indoors and partly outdoors. Well, amphipathic means having dual feelings. And only certain molecules are like this, including phospholipids. We say that it has dual feelings because an amphipathic molecule is polar on one part of the molecule and nonpolar on the other part of the molecule. Well, we've discussed a little bit about polarity already. Polar things like to be around other polar things. Nonpolar things like to be around other nonpolar things. But polar things don't like to be around nonpolar things, and vice versa. This is exactly why oil and water don't mix. Oil is nonpolar because it's fats. Fats are nonpolar because they're mostly hydrocarbons. And hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar because carbon and hydrogen equally share their electrons, because they have the same electronegativity. Right, so you can pour oil into water, it's going to disperse a little bit, but then it's going to clump together because those fat molecules in the oil are trying to escape the water and get just by each other. Okay? Well, a phospholipid has two fatty acid tails, just like the three that are on a fat. And those are carbon and hydrogen only, except for the very tip, which means that they are nonpolar. The phosphate is beyond polar because it's an ionized functional group. So it has a full charge, not just a partial charge. So in cartoon form, we usually depict a phospholipid, of which there are different types, but any given phospholipid is depicted as a sphere for a head and then two tails. The head is called hydrophilic. That's where the phosphate is. It's polar. Hydrophilic literally means water-loving. Hydrophilic is a word that's equivalent to polar because polar things like to be around other polar things, and you already know that water is polar. So water-loving, hydrophilic means polar. Hydrophobic literally means water-fearing. The tails are hydrophobic because they are just carbon and hydrogens. They're hydrocarbon tails, and they are therefore nonpolar. So we talked about that Miller-Urey experiment that mimicked earlier Earth. Before there were any cells, conditions on Earth were sufficient to produce organic molecules out of inorganic molecules, right? Including phospholipids. And when you have almost a billion years for things to build up, a lot of things can build up. So eventually, when you have enough of these phospholipids together, you start forming cell-like structures. You can still do this today. A phospholipid is not a living thing. It's just a molecule. But you take a sample of pure phospholipids, billions of them, and put them into a sample of pure water, nothing to do with any life, and they will automatically self-assemble into a bilayer of phospholipids, which is what cell membranes are made out of. Plasma membranes are phospholipid bilayers. And we'll talk more about that in a chapter that's devoted to the membrane. But truly important molecule as far as life is concerned. Doesn't make sense to even think about life without them. We see in slide 13, even though we will talk about it in a different chapter, a phospholipid bilayer. Now, this is not a complete plasma membrane of a living cell, because a living cell can't have only phospholipids. And that's because a pure phospholipid bilayer will exclude certain things from getting through it. It will allow some things through, but some things can't. Some of those things that can't get through it need to be gotten through it in order to get things into or out of a cell. And we'll talk about those things later, but this is what I was just saying would happen if you take phospholipids and put them into water. They'll automatically make this bilayer. This is a monolayer, one layer of phospholipids. This is another monolayer, but they arrange themselves tail to tail. And they do that simply because the tails, since they are hydrophobic, nonpolar, are trying to avoid being around the water molecules that are polar. The way to do that is to form this bilayer. The heads are hydrophilic because of the phosphate group. They not only don't have a problem being around water, they want to be around water, whether it's on the inside of this sphere or the outside. And so that's how the first cells came into existence. They weren't yet living cells. They were first micelles made out of phospholipids. Okay, now to 14, a different kind of lipid is shown here. Something I talked about in an earlier chapter. Do you have a guess at what this is? Well, it can be made into hormones, and that's where you saw something very similar to it before in an earlier chapter.
Steroid.
This is a steroid, but which one specifically? It is the precursor molecule from which all steroids are made in animals. But you can make estrogen out of this. No, this is a lipid. It is cholesterol, which, notice by the name, is what kind of substance? It's an alcohol because of this hydroxyl. Cholesterol, by the way, in case you're interested, is an alcohol. That's the OL. The stare part, like in stereo, means solid. Stereophonic sound makes it sound like it's three-dimensional, solid, in other words. And coal is another name for bile. So cholesterol literally means bile solid alcohol. It's a major component of bile, which is what the liver makes. But animals make this, non-animals don't. Plants make a similar sterol, but it's not cholesterol. They're called phytosterols. Now, cholesterol gets a bad name in the press health-wise because too high a level can lead to health problems. But no animal can exist without it for the reasons I've already talked about. There's other reasons as well. Cholesterol is vital for animals. Plants don't make it, though, at all. I, for instance, am vegan, have been a vegan for about 8 years. So I haven't had any cholesterol in my diet for 8 years. But I can still have a too high a cholesterol level. Why is it that I have cholesterol in my body? Because I'm an animal, yes. Animals make cholesterol because they can't exist without it. So you make your own cholesterol because you're an animal, but if you eat animals, you're taking in even more than your body makes. Anyway, that's another lipid. So we've looked at three major subcategories of lipids. That brings us to 15, which is the beginning of proteins. Now, for the moment, until we get to a different chapter in which I'll explain the difference, I'm going to use the words protein and polypeptide more or less interchangeably. That's not always justifiable, but I'll explain why later. But if I call them a polypeptide in this chapter, it points out that they're polymers. Anyway, protein, polypeptide, for the moment, think of them as the same thing. And slide 15 is a table that makes a good point, namely that compared to the other categories of macromolecules, proteins have a hugely diverse set of functions. And I've already said multiple times in other lectures that proteins do all the important jobs in cells. When we first started talking about DNA, I told you that we like to say that DNA gives us our traits, or any organism its traits, but it's really the proteins that give an organism its traits. And the reason DNA is involved is because DNA tells the cell how to build specific proteins. There's really no limit to the number of proteins that can be built, but no cell can build any protein unless it has specific instructions for how to do that, and that's what DNA is for. So in any given organism, there's a lot of different proteins being produced, namely the ones that the DNA of that organism tells it it's able to produce. And that's why you're stuck with only those kinds of proteins. For instance, on the cow example earlier today, if you had the gene that bacteria do, then your cells would know how to build the enzyme that can break cellulose down into glucose molecules, and you could eat the paper and get actual nutrition from it. You're stuck with the proteins you're able to make because you're stuck with the DNA you inherited. Anyway, though, proteins in general do, if they don't, well, that they are involved at least in all major processes in a cell. And that list of functions is truly diverse, you can see from these listings. Each of these is a category, so there's many different examples within each of these rows. But notice how they differ from each other. For instance, some proteins are used as enzymes. And enzymes are proteins that act as catalysts. We'll have much more to say about them later, but a catalyst is something that speeds up a chemical reaction. And this, you have thousands of different enzymes speeding up different kinds of chemical reactions. So a big fraction of your genome, the amount of genes you have, is devoted to telling the cell to build specific kinds of enzymes. But that's just one way in which proteins operate. You also have structural proteins that give your body some sort of structural support. Collagen, for instance, is a big one in animals. It's a major component of strong parts of your body. There are storage proteins as well. I talked about storage polysaccharides. Fats and glycogen are how we animals store most of our energy. We don't typically store it as proteins because of what I told you before. Protein has a fairly low energy density. So if we stored our extra stored energy as protein, we would have to be much bigger than we are, and we would weigh more, and that would be more expensive to move us around. So it's wasteful. But there are examples of storage proteins, including egg white, for instance. Transport proteins refer to proteins that act to move things around, and your blood, which is an unusual tissue because it's liquid, well, it has cells in it, and it has a watery part called plasma. Everything in blood other than the cells is the plasma. And the plasma is mostly water, but in there are proteins of various types called the plasma proteins. And a bunch of these proteins are specialized for carrying things around in the blood, because that's really what the blood is all about, carrying things from one part of the body to another. It's always moving. Hemoglobin is just one example. There's all kinds of plasma proteins doing the same job, but hemoglobin is specifically for carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide around in the blood. There are also many proteins that act as hormones. Hormones, as we've talked about, are chemical signals. They cause things to happen that wouldn't happen if the signal weren't present. Well, hormones are signals that are put into the bloodstream, and therefore they're broadcast throughout the body, because the blood goes everywhere there are living cells. And so that's different from other locally acting signals like neurotransmitters that don't go throughout the body. But anyway, hormones that are broadcast by being in the blood can be made out of protein, or they can not be made out of protein. There are other ones that are lipid-based. And most of them are protein-based, including things like insulin, for instance, and so on. Receptor proteins. Okay, now, before we leave hormones are signals. And what did I tell you about signals? What has to be true for them to do anything?
To match the receptor?
Yes. A hormone, or any signal in general, has no effect unless and until it binds to a receptor that is specific for that signal. The receptor has to have just the right shape. Well, whether the signal is a protein or not, and sometimes it is, the receptor is always a protein. So even signals that are not protein have to bind to a protein receptor somewhere in order to have any effect. And the reason that proteins make such excellent receptors is because a receptor has to have a specific shape, and proteins have really no limit to the number of shapes they can have. Well, each given protein has a specific shape, but there's no limit to the number of proteins that could be created if you were designing them in a lab, and therefore there's no limit to the number of shapes. By the way, that's why there is such a diversity of functions for proteins in general. Whatever the specific function is for a given protein, which are any of these categories, it has that specific function because of its specific shape. And proteins, compared to the other macromolecules, have much more variety of shape. Okay, so then we get contractile and motor proteins. These are also about moving, but not moving things around within the body. For instance, they're about moving body parts. So your muscles, your skeletal muscles, all your muscles, but if you think about your skeletal muscles, the ones that are connected to bones, the reason those are able to contract, get shorter, and therefore pull on the bones to move joints is because of interactions between proteins. And then finally, defensive proteins. Part of your immunity comes from the fact that you're producing antibodies. You know, that's what a vaccine, like a COVID vaccine, causes your body to do. It tells it to produce specific shaped antibodies, which are proteins, that can recognize just that particular kind of invading agent, whether a virus or an organism. And therefore, if you already have an army of those antibodies on hand and you get exposed, they will just eliminate the invader before it can get a hold and cause a problem health-wise. Now, appreciate how totally different these functions are in this list. But they're all proteins, and that's because proteins can have just about any shape. Looks like I just ran out of time. And that's exactly where I wanted to get, so good shape.